Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today is a day of thanksgiving for having been delivered from something which should never have been bequeathed and which has proved as hard to be rid of as scabies. We have good reason to be thankful this National Day of Gluttony and genial patriotic hypocrisy. This year's Thanksgiving is not the usual traditionally vapid ideological fiction, but truly a victory, however brief, of democracy over despotic tyranny, of truth especially defeating a suffocating miasma of untruths that spread across the USA like killer smog. We have, as a people, though severely divided, yet performed a revolution to save our original revolution, with the much scorned vote, our first freedom, more powerful than gunpowder. Last Thursday was the anniversary of President Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, in which he extolled that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Today is Thanksgiving Thursday, which Lincoln sanctioned as a national holiday, and which this year, 2020, celebrates our own keeping the faith of Lincoln's promise to our revolutionary ancestors that despite our own worst tendencies, we still choose liberty over slavery. Writer Timothy Egan is apprehensive about Trump's maledictory effect upon the future of democracy. He wrote the following for the New York Times. Donald Trump is leaving behind blueprints to end democracy. Just when we thought we could sleep again, just when we thought his malevolent reign was over, his poison bottled, that the sun was coming out tomorrow, just when nearly 80 million Americans could shout the words of Dr. Seuss to Marvin K. Mooney, please go now. Then this, a shameless attempt to reject the will of hundreds of thousands of voters in the most populous county in Michigan, and ultimately hand the state that Joe Biden won by some 157,000 votes over Donald Trump. And this, in Nevada and Pennsylvania, Trump's campaign asked courts to thwart the choice of a majority of voters and award their state's electoral college votes to the only president in history to lose the popular vote twice. It promised evidence of fraud, but produced none. It was a blunt, raw, purely Trumpian move. Try to stop me. And this, Trump has invited Michigan legislators to the White House in a last-ditch and legally dubious effort to subvert the election. What's unfolding is an attempted coup by a con. It's a bigger political scandal than Russian interference 4 years ago. And yes, it is likely to fail, and the system is likely to prevail. But the American majority cannot rest nor rely on its sense of decency until the election hooligans are beaten back. Failing in court, this most authoritarian of presidents is pressuring little Trumpers everywhere to overturn an election that Trump's own cybersecurity chief, Christopher Krebs, said was the most secure in American history. He's been trying to force canvassers, certifiers, election board referees, and state legislatures to create enough chaos so that he can steal a win. The good news is that a decent majority of Americans think the election was conducted freely and fairly, a belief that has the added benefit of being true. Krebs, a Trump appointee who oversaw defense of the election for the Department of Homeland Security, issued a statement saying there is no evidence that any voting system deleted or lost votes, changed votes, or was in any way compromised. that assessment got him fired by the president. The bad news is that an indecent majority of Trump voters think Biden won because of fraud, the big lie that the election was rigged unless Trump is declared the winner, thrives in the disinformation ecosystem. Since the election, I've been trying to remain open-minded about what moved more than 73 million Americans to vote for Trump, knowing that he's an awful human being and a nation wrecker, trying to soil every institutional value we hold sacred. I understand the tribalism, the urge to push back against condescending libs and the suffocating ubiquity of political correctness, the sense that only Trump can save a certain way of life. But then Trump unleashed his flying monkeys to try to take back the office he lost by nearly 6 million in the popular vote. Consider just how openly racist and undemocratic the Michigan debacle was. Two white Republican canvassers refused to certify the results of the state's most populous Democratic county, which contains black-majority Detroit. Was there evidence of fraud? No. The fig leaf was the routine clerical and counting errors found throughout Michigan, and certainly not enough votes to overturn the results. One of those canvassers, Monica Palmer, suggested that the white majority areas of the county could be certified, while the black majority city of Detroit could not. The pro-Trump canvassers relented only after being buried under an avalanche of outrage and threats. But after the president called at least one of them, both Republicans again attempted to keep Wayne County's votes from counting, although by then it was too late. This was a racial disenfranchisement move so blatant it would make Jim Crow blush. Michigan Republican leaders applauded this, and Trump tweeted, "Flip Michigan back to Trump." Among the national Republican leaders, those with a conscience, a group that could fit in a broom closet, had been quiet. "Humor him," they said. "He'll eventually sulk away." It wasn't just the black majority in Detroit the Republicans tried to render powerless. The votes of veterans and first responders, the sick and disabled, first-time voters and long-time voters were headed for a garbage bin to please a loser crying for a do-over. "American democracy cracked last night, but it didn't break," said Mayor Mike Dugan of Detroit on the morning after the certification back and forth. "We are seeing a real threat to everything we believe in." One of those beliefs is the idea that honorable people will put aside partisan passions to keep the machinery of democracy moving forward. But it's pretty hard to do that when the routine act of ballot counting has become a life-threatening job. Arizona's Secretary of State, Katie Hobbs, described ongoing and escalating threats of violence, quote unquote, against her and her family for trying to perform her duty. This is Trump's legacy, an attempt to blow up an election from Wayne County, Michigan to Maricopa County, Arizona. For Trump, the failed businessman, cheating and suing were a way of life. For Trump, the failed president, cheating and suing are a blueprint for his followers into the future. And I fear there's no going back. And that was "Donald Trump is Leaving Behind Blueprints to End Democracy" by Timothy Egan, who is a contributing opinion writer to the New York Times and covers the environment, the American West, and politics. He is a winner of the National Book Award and author most recently of A Pilgrimage to Eternity. And many people have known him in Astoria when he was working his beat many, many years ago. And he wrote a number of incredibly good books like The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America, and The Good Rain, which won the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Association Award in 1991. And he also wrote the great book, Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, The Epic Life and Immortal Photographs of Edward Curtis, which he wrote in 2012. And now, something I've written. Auld Lang Syne for Thanksgiving 2020. Now it has been a year past a quarter century since Matthew Joseph Snyder crashed his surfboard against a rocky cliff in the Columbia River Bar and was thus unable to be among who crossed the time reef between millennia 6 years later. He was 24 that early November day in 1994, smart, gifted, irreverent, solid promise of steady flowering, an irretrievable loss of a promising younger, his death a thwart to regeneration, the best of a generation, lost before its prime. The future in jeopardy because the best and brightest are unavailable just when needed most. Matthew Snyder did not cross over into this third millennium of our parochial calendar among the sentient protoplasm somewhere up front where he belonged, a standout guy. He probably would not have been a political titan or a media mogul, certainly not a corporate or financial creature, not a priest or a shrink either. More a Pied Piper, whose infectious and uncensored vitality lifted spirits and eyebrows, outbursts of laughter. Loyal, adventurous, and funny, off the wall, friends and family said. He flirted with a woman who rebounded every quip, a publicly conducted and playful exchange of wit, masking as romance. He was the best verbal sex I ever had, she said. In the short term, Matt's death appeared of little except local consequence. He was not wealthy or famous, though he might have got to be. Probably never rich, but famous for his genuine originality that exhibited no trace of arrogance or condensation. The long term, however, definitely exhibits symptoms of distemper at his early absence. Matt had good genes, necessary, warn the spirit kind of genes. Our beleaguered species loses caprice and whimsy without his receding. His legacy is essentially as a cultural embryo. His retrospect has shown a vital link of bohemian legacy and genuine millennial avant-garde Zen-Ogami. His lineage traces back to Homer and Lao Tzu, inflamers of the spirit, funnels of thought and memory. And he also resembled the early gods, the playful imps, who were responsible for the fun and well-being that gives human folks courage and hope to face the future, though it inevitably brings tragedy and death. We who knew Matt Snyder are left to continue remembrance of him and what we learned from him, to refresh his inspiration, to portray our memories of him as a necessary template now and tomorrow. In retrospect, on that day Matt fell off his surfboard, an ordinary day of human mortality. Perhaps a million people died worldwide, mostly ordinary persons of every age, color, creed, gender, and nationality. Some were most likely murdered, as was a young black man across the Columbia River from Matt's fatal accident, whose body was thrown off the Astoria Bridge a few days earlier. Some were executed for crimes, such as homicide, or for their politics or beliefs. Others KIA in war or other disaccords, combatants and non-belligerents, and most odiously, children, or were slaughtered in obvious genocide. Hit by motor vehicles, whether collided or run down, drowned in capsized watercraft, or simply swimming. Maybe in a plane, similar to an airliner that plowed up an Indiana cornfield that killed everyone aboard a few days before Matt's impact with the Columbia River Bar. Deaths on the job that probably amounted to several hundred or thousand that single day. Or they perished that day from disease, as many thousands are every day 26 years later amidst the COVID-19 pandemic that has spread across the planet every day since the beginning of this year, 2020. 250,000 plus Americans have died so far. In 1994, AIDS was the essential plague, and new outbreaks of tuberculosis levied a toll that day. people died that day also from the usual afflictions, heart attack, old age, starvation, drug ODs, tobacco-induced lung cancer, alcoholism, suicide. Botched abortions or miscarriages might be added to that day's mortality. Yet ominous to the very near future and approaching millennia, more babies appeared that day than dead persons left to make room for them. Ever less space to accommodate the new arrivals every day. Humanity's over numerousness, its singular super spreader to the sixth extinction. In Astoria, Oregon, a small city on the southern shore of the colossal Columbia River, 10 miles inland from the Pacific Ocean, the loss of men and women to both river and ocean has been continually constant for more than two centuries, albeit unknown multitudinous drownings during indigenous eras. Matt Snyder's tragedy was intertwined with the deaths of five locals whose commercial fish boat sank in the Gulf of Alaska in late October that year, 1994. The deaths of six teenagers in a traffic collision a few years earlier transfixed Clatsop County for months. And when two teenage girls were killed in an overturned car, their combined funeral drew overflow crowds that lined two sidewalks outside an Astoria church. It might seem ludicrous to take a single day and make it a metaphor for every day, just as singling out the green stick death of one young man not only a few years past, but also locked away in the vault of a previous, though not long ago, millennium. Yesterday is another country, a writer quipped, the borders are closed. But most ideas about the past and the people who lived long ago are mixed up with the vanity of the present. One of the substantial misconceptions of our era is that early civilizations and the people who lived in them are archaic and beyond any relevance. We consider them antiquated, decayed, even decadent times, vanished into the fog of anachronistic ancientness, the cold, dead hand of the past, as poet Oliver Wendell Holmes expressed. But those were not the old times. They were the young times. This is the old time. Earth is much older. Our species is aged. Our millennial civilization is approaching Alzheimer's. Our early ancestors were not the wintry grayheads we regard them as. We are the grayheads, the balding dotards. Our precursors are instead the vigorous youth of our family tree, ecstatic, restless children, wildly imaginative, avaricious, violent, and pagan as all get out. We are what they bequeathed us, an inseparable thread of maturation. Instead of regarding them as ancient grayheads, we ought to think of them as infants in the nursery of our history. We too often scorn them instead as naive and aboriginal, and we condescendingly regard their epochs as simpler periods compared to our own modernity and sophistication. We forget what they learned for us, nearly everything we know. We are the old ones, born much later than our predecessors, whose brilliant and inspired youth constructed our own golden age. For all our contemporary technological expertise, we are enervating beings absorbed only in our own comfort and complacency, a lazy menopausal fantasy of effortless materialistic paradise, a sign of incipient old age at the cusp of a sixth extinction. A small sense of history's sweep might be the building of an addition to a cottage in Astoria, a hillside city clustered with old wood houses, built in the 19th and early 20th centuries, which remain preserved as long as municipal nostalgia prevails and the city, as a museum without walls, continues as a revenue attraction. The cottage originally resembled a cartoon house, painted white with a sharply peaked red roof, backdrop scenery for Donald Duck and Bugs Bunny during animation's golden years. Laughs were anxiously sought during the Great Depression and World War. The builders of civilization, though seldom its architects, swarmed beneath the arch of their incomplete cathedral, hammering, sawing, enclosing a new room and roof to the little cottage. Soon, plasterers, electricians, plumbers, painters, carpenters replaced the carpenters. And soon also, the refinished recreation was so obvious, its creators were soon forgotten. But these hometown builders who erect the pillars and posts of every society are so honored for their immemorial trade that the only son of a prevalent deity is claimed to have been a carpenter. And they can be seen in ancient reliefs or paintings, and in photographs and films, building, always building, regardless of rises and falls of however many Jerichos, Athens, Romes, or Astorias. Relatively soon on Earth's calendar, the USA and the contemporary world it inhabits with the rest of humanity will be as much artifact as Paleolithic bones. A millennium down the pike, when the two world wars and the rise and fall of the Soviet Union have faded into an obscure historical limbo, one with the fall of Troy and the Crusades, in the eloquence of writer Donald R. Morris. Though humanity's future might include galactic expansion and perhaps also an experience of wealth and luxury produced by its own technology, hardly imagined by even today's cyber hedonists, it might also contrarily succumb into a soylent green world, hot, dirty, overcrowded, and hungry with climate catastrophe on the near horizon. The new graft on the old Astoria cartoon cottage will soon enough wither and disappear, as well as its builders, the small river city of Astoria, and this entire, swiftly terminating era. Time's impatient neurosis does not allow lingering except in memory and nostalgia. Instants swarm at us like locusts, flailing against us, wearing us away. Memory of us will rapidly fade, and all that is major in our lives will recede, vaguely recalled, pensively, if at all, as it fogs into amnesia. Our successors will recollect our epical tenure with patronizing contempt, if at all, as they hasten to their own black hole oblivion and devolution, until at last the Homo sapiens species extincts like the dinosaurs and dodo, murdered or harakiried or dissolute decrepitness, the final adios of us all. If human intelligence doesn't entirely destroy Earth, perhaps another ambitious species might emerge from the mud or saline to fill the vacuum. Maybe not. Homo sapiens might flare at the final moments as dying stars, civilizations, and billions of individual hominids do at the end of their lives, a brief reflowering of youthfulness, instant replay of bright morning before eternal night. In autumn and winter, that portion of Earth is Thanatos, a vast rotting organism of dead flesh, each handful of dirt a grave for something. Every footfall on the ground trods on a corpse, as William Cullen Bryant imagined in a famous poem early in the 19th century, Thanatopsis. The golden sun, the planets, and the infinite host of heaven are shining on the sad abodes of death through the still lapses of ages. All that tread the globe are but a handful to the tribes that slumber in its bosom. Take the wings of morning and the barren wilderness, or lose thyself in the continuous woods where rolls the Oregon and hears no sound save his own dashings. Yet the dead are there, and millions in those solitudes, since the flight of years began, have laid them down in their last sleep. The dead reign there alone. So shalt thou rest, and what if thou withdraw in silence from the living, and no friend take note of thy departure? All that breathe will share thy destiny. And that was a segment from Thanatopsis, A Meaning of Death, The Great Tomb of Man, Thanatos, Death, from Greek, Opsis, Sight. The line where rolls the Oregon is the Columbia River's alternate identity, as also the land around it. Total and sudden obliteration might really be something to imagine. Nukes, AIDS, the current pandemic plague, swirling around the globe. Gaia's hysterectomy, an astronomical stench of nearly 10 billion decomposing human corpses littering the planet, plus the festering remains of whatever might be left of the rest of the natural world, not already extinct at our hand earlier. Maggots last. Back at the cusp of the last millennium, Matthew Joseph Snyder became Thanatos early. His wit and sagacity lost this millennium, except in memory, among a few who still miss him as he recedes eternally into the past. This is Michael McCusker. The engineer has been Dylan Hauser Schulk. 2 days ago in 1874, barbed wire was invented by Joseph Glidden. And yesterday in 1867, dynamite was patented to Alfred Nobel, two vital and hellish ingredients for wars evermore. Vietnam War veteran and anti-war activist John Forbes Carey, who was once cheated out of the presidency through lies and perfidious politics, has been named the first ever climate czar to the brand new presidential team of Joseph Biden, Kamala Harris, et al. Among his first acts should be contact with Greta Thunberg and a children's crusade against climate change. Stay home and visit virtually with family and friends today, rather than risk pandemically spreading death and disease among kin and kindred. Remember, protecting yourself protects everybody else. Happy Thanksgiving. Although the real day of Thanksgiving will be January 20th, 2021, when Donald Trump is evicted from the White House, he has villainously tarnished and desecrated these past 4 years.